Session number 12506, Mr. Jack Plotzka, Reel 1.
Mr. Jack Plotzka, Reel 1. Mm. And if I could ask you first of all, Mr. Plotzka, about your background, you know, where you were born and brought up.
Yeah.
This would have been, of course, before World War One, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, I was born in Leeds on the 2nd of August 1900.
A long time ago.
Yes.
Tell me something about your family and the life
you led. Mother and father. Well, there were more than mother and father. There were sweethearts for the rest of all the life. And there was four boys and two girls. And father had shops. And when I was very young, I must have been about, round about six or seven, they left Leeds and went to live in Sheffield. And in Sheffield, he had a shop in Sheffield on the Moor, and he was there for a few years. And in Sheffield, we lived in Collegiate Crescent. And from Collegiate Crescent, we was there a few years, and then we opened a shop in Liverpool, and we moved to Liverpool. And it was from Liverpool we was there for about, I was on the boat in 1915. And I think we moved there in, must have been in 1910. Or it was just the time, I think, after the King Edward died, you know, in between that and the First World War. And then when we lived in Liverpool, then I was on the boat, sailing on the boat as a steward. And I was on the boat right through till end of 1917.
Something about your sort of the family religion?
All Jewish religion, yes. And my father was always he wasn't really what you call Orthodox, but he was always a religious man and attended synagogue. And up to the time he died, a few months before he died, he walked to synagogue when we lived in London. But as for the Liverpool, as I say, in 1917, then I went in to do, called up for the army. I'd been already on the boats for years, and
Yes, I'd like to ask you first of all, you know, about your experience on the boats. But when World War One broke out, when the war started, I was thinking your name sort of sounds rather like German. I was wondering, did your family have any problems because of that?
Not at all. No, there was no problem. My mother was born in Sheffield, and father came over as a child. I think, I don't know whether it was Poland or Germany, but he came over as a child. He was, you know, and he was very, but he was always for the synagogue. And when we lived in London, he was the trustee and all that in the synagogue, Shepherd's Bush Synagogue in London. We left Liverpool while I was in the army.
But Yes, if you could tell me now about your experience in the Merchant Navy during the war. You know, first of all, when you were called, you say you were called up into the Navy, were you? Or did you volunteer?
No, voluntary. I was only 15 when I went on the boats.
Yes.
When I went on the boats, I was only 15, and that was the first trip as a steward's boy. And I remember on the boat coming back, but I don't remember going over. I was so seasick going over the first trip. But after that, I did that, and I liked it. So I kept on the boats. And the first boat, from what I can remember of, that was going to Montreal. And Montreal, there was the boys, English boys, that had been living in Canada, that had voluntarily joined up in Canada they were Americans. Actually, they were Americans, and they volunteered to come over and fight. That was before the Americans joined in the war. And they volunteered to come to England to fight, and we picked them up in Montreal and brought them over to England.
Did you sort of mix with them and speak to the soldiers, the would-be soldiers?
Oh, yes, there was one or two there. We used to want to call it, have a little game of... Oh, yes, yeah. And then, that was the first trip, and then... After that, I went on what they called a Western Ocean run. That was from Liverpool to New York. That was on the St. Louis, American line. That was an American line. But I was on the boats. Chiefly, I worked for the White Star Line. And then after that, I went on one boat and called the Atahualpa, which was a boat belonging to the Booth Line that ran up to the up the River Straits in Brazil, up the, what we call it, to Brazil and all round that way. And then I came back, and then I went on the Minicada, was it? I think it was the Minicada. Yes, the Minicada, and that was went to Australia, and then that was the one who went trooping to New Zealand. But from that trip. That trip was about, months. Because you must remember, when I was on the boats, it was all coal burning. And all I could do was about 500 miles and stop it and pick up coal here and coal there and coal there. I mean, we left Liverpool, and by the time we come down to the coast and got into Belgium, they had to get more coal and pick up the coal again. And then further down the line in Spain and round the corner in Gibraltar and all that. But you must remember, the war was on, and you never knew whether the submarine was chasing you or not.
Yes, I was going to ask you about the sort of enemy threat, if the war made much difference to you.
Oh, yes. The war brought me out, the First World War. I learned quite a lot in the First World War about that.
Was there much worry, though, with submarines, German submarines?
Well, the German submarines, I don't know whether I should tell you, but to my estimation, I think the Irish was keeping them there and supplying them with, because it was impossible for them to get back down onto back into Germany. There was only one entrance to Germany, and if you remember, that was finished, they blocked that during the last war, didn't they, when they sunk the two boats. And that, to my estimation, well, what I think, the Irish was supplying them with food and stuff.
Did you yourself experience any sighting or, were you under direct threat at any time while you were on the water?
Oh, yes, there was once there, and all we had on the boats, one naval gun, and that was aft. There was no, what to call it, there was nothing, there was only one naval gun, but he was a real naval gunner. And I think it was once when we were coming over, when we, when we left. Yeah, I think it was when we left. We'd been to Montreal and we'd been to St. John's, New Brunswick, and coming back over the Atlantic to come in. Anyway, we're supposed to arrive back in Liverpool with the, what to call it, with the troops, but we had to go to Glasgow. We dropped them off in Glasgow because there was a submarine after us, I think. But it was a naval gunner. He fired a couple of shots at something, but whether he was hit it or not, I don't know. But we managed to get to Glasgow. I remember that. And then afterwards, went on another boat. We went out on that boat on to New Zealand. We went out via the Cape, which was round the coast in South Africa, and came back through the Panama Canal. And when we got to the through the Panama to the what do you call it, we got short of coal, and the nearest place was Newport News, Virginia. So when we got to Newport News, Virginia, they wouldn't let any of the soldiers off, only the crew. And before the crew could move, they had to have the passport. This here it is, here. This
oh,
one.
Yes, I can see it, yes.
Yeah, from Newport News, Virginia.
Oh. Oh, yes, I can see that. You got Robert
on the
Warwick,
back,
didn't you?
On the back.
Ooh. February the 2nd, 1918.
Yes.
Well, I never. Ah.
Yeah. And coming back from Newport News, I think there was some afterwards, but it was close to the end of the war. 1918 was close to the end of the war, and they'd sunk a lot of those submarines because the British invented something like a sound detector or a metal detector or something like that, so when they could hear if there was any submarines about. And they sank quite a few. They sank quite a few, yes.
Did you ever have Royal Navy escort, you know?
Oh, yes, it was all, it was all what you call it. We used to go in convoy. Oh, yes, it was
all.
Oh, yes, it was convoy, mostly convoy. But it wasn't convoy when we went to New Zealand. I think it was a bit too far because they're the same as the convoy ships, they were coal burning. And they could only do about 500 mile or 400 mile on a load of coal. So if they went, took you over, you know, throw you over out of the, well, until they got into the Atlantic or a little bit of the way over in the Atlantic. Yeah, but they were very, very scarce. I've got a picture of one in the front room there. Yeah, when it was coal burn, you must remember one place we went to, I think it was on one boat it was on, I think it was the Atahualpa, when we went up the River Plate to Brazil. I think we couldn't get any coal there, and they loaded us up with timber, with the tree trunks and all that kind of stuff to burn, so we could to get away. Oh, yeah.
So what was your job through all this time on the ship?
Stewarding. I've got a son who was who's in South Africa now, but he was the chief electrician on the boats. He's been round the world about four times.
Did the war make much difference to the sort of resources that you had on the boats, would you say? You know, the rationing system, for instance.
Well, it was on one trip, that trip to Australia, I won't forget, New Zealand, it was so together that we began to look like each other, you know what I mean? Yeah, it was a bit awkward, you know, not awkward, but, you know, nobody spoke to the same person over and over and over again, apart from the troops. Going out, we took some Chinese that had been buried in the dead in France, and we dropped those to the Sierra Leone in West Africa. Whether they went back to China or not, I don't know.
How were they treated on the boat, the Chinese? How were they treated compared with the troops?
No, the Chinese was down in the holds. They didn't have any bunks. They wouldn't have what they called, and they slept on the floor. But they all kept together, and they was all pulling out the watches, what they took off the dead bodies, you know, and the rings and all that kind of stuff down there. Yeah, yes. Because you must remember that when the war was on and what they call it, there was no time to bury them, you know. So they had the Chinese bundling them up, and they went over and didn't leave anything on them. They came on the boat at Liverpool, and we dropped them off at Sierra Leone in West Africa.
How did you regard them, the Chinese?
I had no conversation with them at all, no. We had orders not to, so, you know, the skipper was a man from Liverpool, I remember, in Edmonds. His name was Captain Edmonds, and he told us that he didn't actually say to us, don't have anything to, you know, keep away. In the one thing, keep away from them. That's all we got from there, from him.
What sort of state were they in? You know, did they wear uniforms, for instance, the Chinese?
Some of them in what you call it, clothes, you know, ordinary clothes and trousers and that kind of thing. There was one or two that took us, might have got one of the overcoats and slept in it. You know, I never know. I just, you know.
Yes, you look as if you thought they were rather dirty. Is that right?
No, we've all got to live, kind of thing. No, I took them as human beings, like everything else, but you have to keep we don't interfere with them. We don't interfere with them, because if you might say something right and you may say something wrong. But whether they understood you, I don't know. I heard them going off down there, but I don't know whether it was in Chinese or what it was.
Were they well looked after, they, regarding food and water?
Oh, they got the food, yes. They got the Dixies with the cans of tea and all that. Oh, yes, oh, yes. Oh, yes. And everybody on the boat has got to be fed. Everybody. It doesn't matter who it is, right from the cabin boy to the captain. That's in the standing orders, on the ship's orders. Got to be fed. But you must remember that when you're on the boat, the captain, what he says has got to be done. If he says you haven't got to do this, you haven't got to do that. And if he says you can do that, you can do it. But he is actually the law. He is the law on that boat. Yes, captain. Not doesn't matter if you can do what you can say what you like, to the second officer or the first officer. But you mustn't, not to the captain, because he can put you in chains and keep you there till you get home.
Did that happen?
Oh, yes, it does happen. Oh, yes, it does happen. Yes. Oh, yes, if the court fighting order come back offshore and they're drunk and, you know, and cause trouble and the civilian police come onto the boat and say that some of your crew has been at it, put you in iron.
When you arrived in New Zealand,
I'll tell you about that. Now, when we arrived in Wellington, we went to two places. We went to the North Island and we went to the South Island of New Zealand. And the North Island is a place called Wellington. And in Wellington, we had nothing, no soldiers on board. It was just the crew. and they invited us to the Solar Strength Society. It was like a building, you know, with what you call it. And we went in there. We had tea there, and they'd like asked us if we'd like to go up in the mountain to Whanganui, in what do you call it. So we went up to Whanganui, and I was sitting there having a cup of tea and a cake, and I saw a head poking out of the door, and I wondered what it was, and I was out there. And as we was leaving, this lady was a lady. She came up to me. She says, "I know you." I says, "What do you mean you know me?" She says, "You live in Sheffield, didn't you?" I says, "Yes." She said, "I used to nurse you." So she said, I said, "What?" So she said, she'd made a mistake. It was my brother that she used to nurse. She knew my name. She knew my name, you see. She knew my name and what they call it. So it shows you how big the world is when you go like that. That was in Wellington. But as I say, once a sea need is never forgotten. yeah. But the world actually is only small, isn't it? Yeah.
So you were treated... They welcomed you, did they, the New Zealanders?
Oh, yes. If I had my time over again, that's the place I'd go and live. Yeah, it's marvellous. Australia is more of a Russian country. It's like America. I've been to America a few times, you know, on the boat there, and it's all rush, rush, rush. But in New Zealand, they take the time. They've got every all the time. In those days, I don't know about what it is today. Don't know what it is today. I mean, I've been to South Africa about five times. Since 1970, my son was...
Getting the troops, were they all New Zealanders then, the troops you brought back?
No, there was Maoris. Oh, there was what do you call it? The troops... there was New Zealand troops as well, and they was from we brought their guns back, but their horses must have come over in another ship, and that they were called the King Edward Light Horse Artillery, and the Maoris they were dressed as in the ordinary uniform as the New Zealanders, but they was more like the Gurkhas, you know, with the knives and things like that. But they were very, very educated, those Maoris, and coming back through the Panama Canal, they were doing the mariaka, the dancing in the crowd, all standing there. Oh, yeah. Yes, it was very good on that trip. I think it lasted, I think, about nearly enough 6 months, because we couldn't go in those days on a straight course. It was what they call a zigzag course, you know, in case there was anything about.
And where did you take the troops to?
Came back to England, and then they embarked and went over to France. Oh, they were all for France there.
Did you actually mix with the troops, you know?
We had to, what do you call it? All the boats those days were, if there was any cabins, it was all dismantled. And all they had was hammocks, like they did on Nelson flagship, see? Because if you had cabins, it means to say that you had... You could only put one in a cabin, and you'd have to have 100 cabins. And when you've got about 600 or 700 men on a boat like that, you couldn't have 600 or 700 cabins. So they had hammocks, and then they had a table, a big table, and divided into about four different sections. And then they used to sit round there, and we used to go up into the galley and get the tea and their food and bring it down on a tray and then put it on the table, and they used to serve themselves. Or the head man, I suppose it must have been the sergeant, who used to divide it up and cut it up and divide it amongst the soldiers. But in the ordinary way, when you've got passengers, naturally you serve it at the table. Different altogether with troops.
Were the Maoris treated any differently?
No. The Maoris had the Maoris were just the same. They wasn't mixed at all. No. There was no distinction at all between the Maori and the New Zealander. It's just the same. In fact, the Maoris was more educated than some of the New Zealanders. But they wasn't what they call it, as what you see, you know, with all the tattoos round their face. There was ordinary. Like a little bit chocolate coloured, light chocolate coloured, yes. But they were very educated, and the things they used to do was to sit down there and take a bit of wood and cut out a figure or something like that, yes. Where the ordinary New Zealand soldiers were playing cards and all that kind of, oh yes. Oh yeah, they were very good.
You were saying what a long time it took.
Yeah.
Did you have any problems with sort of discipline or morale on the boats? You know, I was wondering if there were any fights. Or
No. You couldn't afford to have problems, could you? When you're on a boat like that, you've got to do what you're told, and as long as you do that, you're all right. It's very good on that. I don't know what it is today. Mind you, of course, today, every person, seaman or steward and everything, has got his own cabin today. You know what you call it? We had what they call those a glory hole, and that was bunks on top of one another, about four. Oh, yes, four on top of one another, and all you had a little locker.
Well, thank you very much for telling me about your experience in the Merchant Navy.
Yeah.
But it's interesting now that you were called up. Is that because you had achieved the age of
calling up for the army? Yes.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I could have appealed. I could have, what do you call it? I could have got on another boat and gone to Australia again and averted it, but. Mother, you know, she said it was a long time ago, we've been on the boats a long time, we haven't seen you, and we never know what's going to happen, and there's a war on, kind of thing, and you know, you might get bumped off or something like that. So it's better that you go into the army. So I went into the army, and the funniest part of it was we lived in Liverpool at that time. I was called up, and what they was going to do was they sent me to a place called Seaforth, and that was the place of the Seaforth Highlanders. You imagine me in kilts. So. They said to me, they said, well, what about the Jewish regiment? I said, what Jewish regiment? He said, the Royal Fusiliers. I said, the Royal Fusiliers? I said, that's, what do you call it? There's no Jewish regiment. He says, it's the 38th and this is the 40th Battalion at the Royal Fusiliers, if you want to join that. So I said, yes, all right, I'll join that. And they gave me the pass, and I went down, and I had to go to, I went to Plymouth. And when I got to Plymouth, got enough on there.